Vigilantes. Today we have a very special guest, and that's Paul Poole himself, founder and CEO of Edge Wallet. Paul, how you doing?
Doing well. How's it going, Raphael? Nice seeing you again.
Likewise. Very good to have you here. And I've been bumping into you in several conferences, and I really wanted to get into the architecture of Edge itself. Now, Edge, over time, has become our favorite wallet at the Crypto Vigilante. Disclaimer, we have no affiliate marketing with no company whatsoever because we are completely independent. And if anyone fucks up, we don't want to feel like we are obligated to still back them up. No, we are objective. And if we like something, we call it out. And we like it. So Edge, for people that are new into crypto, is the wallet that we recommend the most. For anyone that's new, we recommend it. Now, the architecture of Edge is one that has changed over the years. Edge has been revolutionary in that it was the first wallet to adopt Libitcoin, which was the dark wallet implementation of Bitcoin for more privacy on Bitcoin. And over the years, it's even changed its name from Airbits to Edge. And now it's emphasizing its non-custodial exchange. Could you please explain all of this, Paul, and where we're at with Edge?
Got it. So while you're going way back in history to the early 2014, 2015 days as Airbits, and you're right. Yes, we started as Airbits. It was a Bitcoin-only wallet. It used both inside of the app, the open source library by Amir Taki called LibBitcoin. And that was just a simple library in C++ to create transactions for Bitcoin. And it broadcasted them and queried the network using the LibBitcoin full nodes. And I really respect Amir for having rewrote an entire full node from scratch in C++ that replaced the need for Bitcoin Core. So that was our earliest first implementation. We expanded to support not just LibBitcoin nodes, but also Electrum nodes. So that support was all in there inside of our app in the original Airbits days. We've since pivoted in a way, slight pivot of the company when we turned into Edge. And Edge we define as a self-custody exchange, meaning that it lets people buy, sell, and trade Bitcoin and a bunch of other cryptocurrencies, but always holding their own keys. You might have funds flow through an exchange, either whether it's for converting fiat to Bitcoin or Ethereum to dollars or whatnot, or you might be converting crypto to crypto, you might flow through an exchange, but at all points in time, once the trade is settled, funds are sitting inside of your own keys that you control. And we try to achieve that with a high level of privacy. We don't collect any personal information in the app. Our fiat partners might collect personal information, but we never see any of that. We don't know balances that people have inside the app. All of that is entirely in the app itself, encrypted by the user's credentials. We don't see balances. We don't know when people make transactions. We may know that a transaction happened with one of our exchange partners, but we don't know who did that. We just know that, oh, someone swapped $500 of Bitcoin to ETH. We don't know who it is, but we know that it happened just so we know what kind of revenue we're going to collect from our exchange partners. But like you said, yes, it has evolved over the years. We still support Electrum nodes. We don't use the LibBitcoin code anymore because, number one, when we turned into Edge, we changed the code base into JavaScript, which is no longer compatible with LibBitcoin. So, you know, just technical requirements for us to switch over to new libraries. We did support Bcoin, which was developed by another team, JavaScript, also an alternate open source implementation of Bitcoin. So I'm really all about new implementations of cryptocurrencies. I love that Ethereum has multiple full node implementations, and Bitcoin really needs more than just that one Bitcoin core implementation. And I think all of the coins should also strive in that regard. So that's kind of just kind of scratching the surface of the history of Edge, where we came from, but I'm sure there's a lot to talk about as far as what we do today.
Right on. So, so since you guys have no information on the people that hold that use Edge, if any government were to come and ask you for information, what information would you be forced to give them?
It's not the, you know, it's definitely happened. We've had calls, you know, from FBI and whatnot asking, hey, is this address one that is held on your service? And all we can say is we don't know. You know, even if that person, they may have subpoenaed some emails and those people might have mentioned Edge. It's possible, but we don't know because that address isn't in any way transmitted to Edge servers. Like those addresses go out to the decentralized network to query people's balances and transactions. And when they create a transaction, they don't go to our system. They create a transaction on their own phone that then broadcasts that transaction out onto the decentralized network. This is a stark contrast to many non-custodial services, even non-custodial apps I won't say the name, but the one that I think you used to recommend, I believe, connected to their own personal server. So therefore, you'd know all the transactions that their users were creating and the addresses that they were creating. And there's quite a few others. It is way more efficient to do that. Don't get me wrong. It's actually a huge efficiency gain. It's a lot easier to know all of your users' addresses. But we go through a lot of the extra heavyweight lifting to try to retain a higher level of privacy by us not knowing that. So to answer your question, yeah, if they come to us, we just tell them the way our architecture works. And they almost always go, okay, well, there's nothing we can do here. And then of course, you know, to be a good Samaritan, good citizen, we try to help them in whatever way, which is really just understanding the technology, right? Because many times they don't understand technology. So we help them understand technology, but they, for the most part, you know, go away and find some other way of tracking down the bad guy.
Okay, right on, right on. So just to reiterate, if you're buying crypto with fiat, then you will require KYC from your fiat exchange partners, correct?
Almost 90% of the time. We have one exchange partner. We have about 8 exchange partners for fiat. One of them, which unfortunately doesn't cover people in the US, which I presume a good number of your listeners are from the US and a few other countries. But if you're in Europe, which maybe some of your listeners are in Europe, if you're in Europe, you can actually buy up to $1,000 worth of Bitcoin with no KYC from your bank account in Europe. So you simply go into the app, say you want to buy, say what country you're in. If you're in Europe, one of the options will be a partner called Bitty. And you say how much you want to buy. It basically gives you a bank account number to send funds to using a SEPA bank transfer. You send the funds and then Bitcoin shows up in your account usually within a few hours. So there is one service that does not require KYC. But realize if you're buying at any point in time using a digital payment method of the legacy fiat world, almost certainly the payment method itself is tied to your identity. So sure, people don't want to do KYC, but if they're going to send a bank transfer over to an exchange, that bank transfer has KYC information associated to it. And so that bank knows that you sent money to some crypto exchange. But it sure is a whole lot better than the crypto exchange itself also having your KYC information, because now you have two entities that could get compromised and leak out your personal info versus just one. So it's, once you touch fiat, almost certainly there's going to be some level of personal information associated. We try to minimize that. But on the crypto to crypto side, by and large, there's no personal information necessary, at least not by default.
So we used to recommend the Exodus wallet for newcomers to crypto. And we stopped recommending it for various reasons. I think you mentioned one. And well, the thing with Exodus is that you have one private key and one mnemonic phrase that represents all of the crypto assets within Exodus. Edge does not work like that. Could you please explain that?
Yep. So with Edge, instead of a user backing up a single master private key, that's what we call that mnemonic. It's usually 12, 24 words. We instead create login credentials, or a user creates login credentials. And that actually encrypts the master private keys that are inside a user's account. So there's a few benefits to this. And here's where we can kind of take some time to kind of analyze our thought process, which can be criticized by many. And many people have criticized this architecture, but many people absolutely love it. This is the people that use Edge and have used it for years. This is why they use it. Is that number one, it's a user experience question. As a user, say I'm brand new to crypto. I don't know what I'm getting into, and I'm just getting involved now. Having to deal with 12 to 24 words that I've never created, right? Some random app creates it for me, and having to write that down is just a user experience alienating event. Right? It just doesn't feel right. I'm like, wait, when do I have to ever back up my money? Tell me a single time in the point of your history where you've ever had to back up your money. That just feels very weird to people. Number two, private keys that you write down and back up can't be two-factored. So if you wrote down that private key and somebody saw it, there goes your money, right? There goes all of your money for all of the different assets that you're storing inside of that app. It's all gone. Login credentials, however, are credentials which actually encrypt your data. In Edge, those login credentials encrypt the private keys and they also back them up. So they're stored in Edge infrastructure, but they're encrypted before they're stored there. And only the user sees the login credentials. To those of your listeners that are a little bit more technical, we hash the login credentials, the username and the password. We hash it in one direction to encrypt the data, and then we hash it in a different direction to authenticate to the servers to upload your encrypted data. So the nice thing about using, you know, kind of standard server infrastructure is that you can two-factor login credentials. And we automatically do that for everybody's account. As soon as you've created your account, it's protected with a light version of 2FA. We call it IP2FA. It's really more IP verification, IP validation. So if you wrote down your login credentials somewhere, or say you reused your password, right? Everyone says don't reuse your password, but say you accidentally did, and that password you used in Edge was reused with something from freaking LinkedIn, which is, I feel like it's been hacked a couple times now. So someone, you know, in Nigeria has your LinkedIn password. They try to log in into Edge with your credentials, they'll get blocked. And you'll get a notification every day for the next 7 days that someone has your password and is trying to log into your account, which you can then block and simply change your password. And they'll have never gotten in. They wouldn't have ever seen your money. So this is the beauty of a kind of a hybrid model where people still own their keys. They control them. Edge doesn't see them. Edge doesn't have control of them. But you have a third party that can help validate the security. In a way, it kind of borrows from a lot of the benefits of multi-sig. It's not multi-sig. In a way, no way am I saying that what we've implemented is multi-sig, but it's borrowing from the security model of multi-sig, which says, hey, let's have multiple parties that kind of have to come together. So this third party that wants to access your account, maybe they have your password, but that's not good enough. You now need this other party, which is Edge, to say, okay, you're allowed in because you're on the same IP addresses that the actual user was on. So that's a second reason. So there's the user experience.
I have a question issue. Real quick.
Sure, go
with
for
the
it.
IP, if you use a VPN, would that invalidate your access to the Edge wallet?
No. So when you create your account, the IP address that you created your account on automatically gets whitelisted. And then that specific device is now whitelisted. That device can roam around any IP address it wants, and it will always have access. Plus, okay, the keys are on your phone. We can't block that. The keys are on your phone.
Right. On.
They're not only with Edge. It's not like you log in and then it downloads the keys every single time you log in. Edge is just a backup. It's an autonomous wallet, just like, you know, Exodus. Like, the keys are on there. So nothing the server can do, nothing that our service can do, can prevent you from having access to the keys that are on your phone. So okay, as you roam, though, as you go and move around different IP addresses and you log in, Edge sees those additional IP addresses and it whitelists them as well. And don't quote me on this, but I believe we have about a 3 to 6 month window where all the IP addresses you've used in the 3 to 6 month timeframe get whitelisted. So if you were to, for example, switch phones, right? So you lose your phone and you log in on a new phone. If you're on the same IP address, which is highly likely, if you're on the same cell phone carrier in the same city or at home or at work, you'll just simply get logged in. No problem. However, an attacker is very unlikely to be on the same IP addresses that you've used. They're probably somewhere else in the world and they'll get blocked and you'll get a notification. So this is the beautiful stuff you can do with a more hybrid model, such as what Edge does, versus just, here's 24 words, go take care of them, don't lose them, and make sure you don't let anyone see them.
Right?
So you can add a little extra layer of security. And then as well, you can also add an extra layer of forgivability, meaning let's make this a bit more forgiving, where users are never going to remember 24 words. They very easily could lose them. Mm-hmm. So Edge also has password recovery capabilities where you do have to set it up. So it's not as simple as like, hey, recover my Gmail password. Just, you know, send me an SMS or something. We don't collect phone numbers and no email addresses. That's part of our privacy model. That actually makes it really difficult for us. But the recovery mechanism allows people to set up a couple questions and answers, personal questions and answers, and then send themselves a recovery link, like from within Edge. Right? Edge will create a recovery link and they'll send it to their email, not from our servers. The user sends it to themselves. So we never see this recovery link. And that's important that Edge never sees the recovery link.
That is really cool, Paul. That's really cool.
It's unique. It's cool. And it's something that, you know, we worked hard for quite a while to figure out. This is way back in the Airbits days. We've had this since Airbits. But that recovery link, in addition to the answers to your questions, allows you to both recover your encrypted keys and decrypt them. So it's another split key model. Really what it is, it's two keys. Two keys that can come together to get access to your account. One key that the user holds inside of their email that they've emailed themselves. Now that's what they do that to set up the recovery process. So that's sitting in their email, you know, don't delete it, it's just sitting there. And another key that is held in Edge. But in order for you to get that other key, You have to provide the right answers to your questions. And even better, you might think, well, great. Am I just providing Edge my personal questions and answers now? Like now they know something about me. Actually, no, because we hash the answers and we encrypt the questions on your phone before Edge gets them. So we actually cannot see the questions and we don't know the answers. Go through this extra effort to provide a higher level of privacy. Only the user can see the questions. You click on that link, that recovery link in the email, it actually contains the key to decrypt your questions. So you can download your questions, but then you decrypt them on your phone. You can see your questions. And when you answer them, that same key hashes the answers. Not that same key, different key hashes the answers. We send that to the server. The server can tell that the answers are the same. So this is the kind of beauty of the model, is that it's both private, but much more forgiving to the user. And, you know, I call it like 90% familiar. It's not 100% familiar, like the way you do password recovery on your Facebook account, but it's close enough.
And this is all open source.
And it's open source. You can know that that's actually what we're doing. Not just our front end, not just the source code that's running on the phone, but also even the code that's running on our server. So when I say this is what the server does, you can validate that by looking at the source code. Now, granted, open source isn't the end all be all to being able to trust a company, because they could say, here's the code that we're going to use, and then use something else. But it's the darn closest that we can do. And we have people in our company that are writing the code. It's trivial for them to effectively blast us for actually doing something other than what we do. So right. By being both transparent, like our staff is all on LinkedIn. We don't try to hide anybody. I know there's some companies that say, hey, for security purposes, you cannot say that you work for this company on LinkedIn. All right. That's what some companies do. Like, they're not allowed to actually put their profile as working for a company. I think Shapeshift did that. And so I get it. You know, it makes it where your staff are harder to fish. You can't fish the staff because you don't know who they are. We'd rather take the standpoint of train our staff not to get compromised, but make it where it's transparent who does work for us. And they then can be pinged, say, hey, is this really what Edge is doing? Right? They claim to do it. Their source code does it, but are they really doing that? It's actually quite a lot of work to publish source code constantly, have it constantly updated, have the names of the developers on the source code, but then actually do something different. It's not an easy thing to do. And then you can always get ratted on by your staff. Like, staff change, you know, and no one has ratted on us because we actually do publish and use the code that we have on GitHub.
Right on. No, that's really awesome, Paul. And so, Paul, for someone who wants to be even more paranoid per se, and they wanted to back up their private keys, you could do that, right? But you would have to go to every individual cryptocurrency on Edge. Yeah. So you would go to Monero, right? Can you please explain that?
Exactly. So that's another thing that, and my own people might say this is a disadvantage of Edge. I'm going to claim it as an advantage for a few reasons. So every single wallet in Edge is a different master private key. In some cases, it's just a private key. It's not like a mnemonic, but we're migrating all of the assets to use mnemonics. But Bitcoin and Litecoin, Doge, those assets all use mnemonics. You'd have to go to each one, show the master private key, and then write it down. That admittedly is a royal pain in the ass. A simpler way would be to get an old phone, log into Edge, and throw that phone into a closet, because it would have downloaded all of your master private keys. And then just throw that thing into a closet. That's now your backup. Right, all those keys are there. You could always get them out if you ever needed to. So what's the benefit of doing this? People are like, well, why do you do that? Why don't you just make one key that derives all your wallets? Well, for one thing, Edge allows you to have multiple wallets of each asset. So you can have multiple Bitcoin wallets. You can delete one and add another, delete three, add four for all different purposes. And all of those wallets are inherently separate from each other. There's no commingling of addresses, which might happen in a single Bitcoin wallet. So you can have as many as you want. Number two, you can import keys. So right now we don't support importing of Bitcoin and similar assets, but Ethereum and other assets like Ethereum, you can import. Soon you'll be able to import any asset. So you'll import keys from other wallets. And all of that will all get encrypted and backed up in the same one Edge account. So that's a huge, huge convenience, because people have complained, oh my God, I've got keys for this app, keys for this app, keys for this app. Effectively, Edge kind of becomes like your key manager, your password manager for cryptocurrency, but you can also use them from within Edge. So that first reason we talked about was you can import, that was the second reason, you can import the keys. Number two, you can have multiple of any asset, right? So that's the number one. You can have multiple of any asset. Number two, you can import keys. Number three, and this one is a little subtle, like people kind of don't realize the advantage of this, but there are times where people may have to compromise one of their wallets, right? Intentionally compromise one of those wallets.
How so?
What do you mean? Case in point example. Yeah, you're like, wait, why would I ever want to compromise one of my wallets? Well, what happens in the case of a fork of a blockchain? So Bitcoin forked to BCH, BCH forked to BSV, Bitcoin forked to hundreds of our Bitcoin blah, blah, blah clones. So a lot of people say, well, okay, how do I get my money out of these forks? Well, many wallets won't support that fork. But instead, they'll say, put your private key in some blah, blah, blah currency, some blah, blah, blah wallet, that they, you know, some maybe fork of Electrum, and then you can take your money out. Well, what did you just do by taking your private key? Number one, just taking and seeing it. As soon as you've seen it, it's partially compromised, right? Like your phone might have actually, had malware that could see your screen. So now you've potentially compromised the key. Another reason why we don't want people writing down keys. Number two, you've put it in some unknown software from some unknown developers that have forked some open source code. And it has been true where Electrum has been forked and it was a malware version of it that people used and it stole their funds. So just to claim the funds for a fork, you end up compromising the funds you already have. So a lot of people will say, okay, what you do is say it's Bitcoin and you wanted to take your BCH out of your Bitcoin wallet. Well, they say, okay, sweep all your Bitcoin out of your wallet first, put it into a completely different wallet, then take your keys and put it into this Electrum clone and take your BCH out. Well, what if you have like 50 different assets on that one master private key? You have Bitcoin, you've got Doge, you've got Ethereum, you know, you got Monero, you got Zcash. What if you, all that one master private key, that's like 50 different coins. You now would have to go in and sweep all of those coins from that one master private key before you take that one master private key and then put it into Electrum, just so you can take out, you know, potentially some shitcoin that you just want to be able to sell.
Right.
That's a huge pain in the ass. You might even forget what you have in there. You don't even know, oh shoot, that's right, I have this other asset in there as well. I got to sweep that one too. By having individual master private keys, you know that, hey, this is the master private key that only holds Doge. And then maybe Doge got forked in some other dog coin. So I sweep my Doge out, take my Doge keys out, put it into this random Electrum, you know, clone, take out my doggy coin too, or whatever it is. And then all the other coins in Edge are totally fine, right? You know that they couldn't have possibly been compromised because they're 100% different master private keys. That's nice. Another core benefit. And it's a subtle one that people don't realize, but we have had people contact us saying, hey, there's this fork of something or other, and I want to blah, blah, blah. And we're like, okay, well, we can tell them only sweep this one coin, right? Take this one coin that you're having to pull the private key out, take the funds out of it first, create another wallet in Edge. That's another beauty, is since you can have multiple wallets of the same asset. In that example of this Dogecoin fork, we'll say, okay, create a second Dogecoin wallet in Edge, totally different private key, transfer funds over to that other Dogecoin wallet. Now take your first Doge wallet and take the private key out. Now go put it in this like Electrum clone and take your doggy two coin out. So these are subtle things and they're kind of corner cases, but boy, is it a royal pain in the ass when you hit this corner case and you haven't used different master private keys for different assets. People don't realize it until you realize it. You know, it's kind of like security. It's not a big deal until it's a big deal.
Right.
So many reasons. It's a combination of all of those that we're pretty happy. They're like, oh yeah, this is a good decision we made early in the days of Airbits, that we create different master private keys. And I think it's by virtue of us having this encrypted login subsystem that can encrypt any key, any data. It's really data encryption, right? That username, password, and Edge encrypts anything you put inside Edge, any number of keys. It's enabled us to provide all of this kind of benefit long-term.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And it's a little confusing at first, especially for people who are used to other wallets. But that's exactly why I wanted to talk to you about this, so that we can shed light on why Edge is different and how to use it properly. So The thing now that we have noticed is that, you know, edge is, you know, your door is being knocked on constantly by cutting edge technology. You guys were the first ones to integrate Monero and have a Monero wallet on a, what would you call it? Multi-asset
platform. Yeah. Multi-asset wallet, multi-asset platform. Yep. Everything before Edge was very Monero specific. Like My Monero existed, Monerojo, but they supported only Monero. User experience was a little bit lacking. You know, they weren't widely adopted platforms. You know, they were kind of like your first template app, just so people could transact in Monero. But we were the first that really implemented it in a more broad usable platform.
And now I see that you've been working on integrating Zcash. Mm-hmm. And drumroll, you're also working on Pirate Chain, correct?
We are. Yeah. So we're indirectly working with Pirate Chain, working on Pirate Chain in the sense that Pirate Chain is very, 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 very similar to Zcash, right? And so we took on interest in Pirate Chain and its integration, knowing that we could leverage a lot of the work from Zcash into Pirate Chain. And I really, really loved, and because I've always criticized Zcash for this, the fact that they have transparent addresses and are still retaining them. So one of my biggest, you know, one of the biggest appeals for me to Pirate Chain was the removal of all those like transparent addresses. I love that they did that. So I wanted to support the effort, but of course, with limited engineering resources, it was important that we could leverage the SDK that Zcash and the ECC team built. And so we are in talks with the developers of Pirate Chain to see, okay, well, what are the differences? Are they able to implement those differences? And then where do we pick up the slack from there? But yes, we've already announced and launched live today in the Google Play Store and also direct download from our website, support for Zcash in Android.
That's today?
Zcash. Not today. This was like last month. It's been available. Nice. It's been available since last month. So I think we announced it in December, I want to say, or was it November? Might have already been like November.
I don't use Zcash, so I wouldn't know. I only use Pirate Chain. Why would I use Zcash? You know, like personally.
Well, the one benefit of Edge was the first multi-asset. Well, it wasn't the absolute first, so I take that back. We were, I think, like second multi-asset app to support Zcash in full privacy mode. And we actually removed support for transparent addresses in Edge. So you could not receive into Edge using a transparent address because that would actually compromise the user's privacy. You can send a one, which doesn't compromise Edge users' privacy that much, but it does compromise the recipient, but you can't receive into a transparent address in Edge. So we kind of took the hardline stance that, hey, if you're going to claim to be a privacy coin, we're going to implement it as a privacy coin.
Nice.
But then we've got iOS coming about middle of this month, middle of January. And with those two under our belt, and some modifications to the SDK from ECC, from the Zcash team, we certainly hope that we're going to be able to launch support for Pirate Chain. We would definitely really want to get support for Pirate Chain out there. But of course, there are some engineering hurdles that we have to get over. Both us and the developers on Pirate Chain have to kind of help get us over those hurdles.
Nice, right on. And is there a tentative timeline for this?
I can't speak of a tentative timeline. I can speak tentative timelines and things where you kind of see the light at the end of the tunnel, where there's no unknowns and it's just simply, we have to do this work. With Pirate Chain, there's still a few unknowns, most of which are on the developer team from Pirate Chain. And once we feel like that's resolved, then we can kind of give a bit better of a timeline, but we generally don't like to pre-announce things. So when we announce things, we'll announce something when it's like say in beta and we want people to play around with it and whatnot. But before then, when there's like, we don't know quite how long it'll be, we don't like to announce a timeline yet. So fortunately, I can't announce anything yet, but keep your ears open. And if you are interested and you're Pirate Chain user, all you are users, feel free to sign up for our newsletter. And believe me, you'll be one of the first to know when we've got support or even a beta out that you can try out.
Nice. Yeah. And you know, a lot of people might ask watching this, you know, why is this important? And the reason why this is important is because it just shows you how adaptability evolves in crypto. So with something like Pirate Chain, which is like cutting edge cryptography, you're at this moment using wallets that are a similar user experience to someone using an early Bitcoin wallet. You're still working with like the wallet.dat files and, you know, this would be a huge step in adaptability for something that's so cutting edge. And the fact that you guys are doing it, like, I think it's really awesome that you guys are doing
Excited. I think it's awesome that the Pirate Chain team is doing things like actually making privacy by default, like making it such that there is no non-private mode. I've been promoting that since the early days of Airbits. Like we always said, there shouldn't be a private mode button in your app. We never had that in Airbits. Like, one of my criticisms of some of the early privacy protocols in Bitcoin, such as Mixing, CoinJoin, mm-hmm. and whatnot, is that they couldn't be baked into the app where the user didn't know it was there. Like CoinJoin was a push this button to mix my funds. Okay, then it's done. Now your funds are private for a little while. And then as you start using them, they become less private. I'm always about, I use the app as if it was not a private app and I just get the privacy automatically. You know, and Monero definitely helped achieve that. And Pirate Chain is on the same path of achieving that same thing. Like I don't have to think about privacy. I know the Zcash team claimed that that's what they want to go towards. And I think there's some concerted effort in that direction as well, but they definitely have some legacy. They have some tech debt, you know, a tech debt that's holding them back from achieving that with their support for these transparent addresses. But, you know, everyone's trying. We're trying hard too.
Okay, right on. I mean, the more competition we have, the better. And what do you mean by tech debt?
Tech debt, in a way, they've launched a platform that had transparent addresses, right? Zcash had transparent addresses. And now you've got a bunch of exchanges and other wallets supporting transparent addresses and only transparent addresses. And so with that, that's technology that you've deployed. And it becomes debt because you now have to put in extra work in order to remove that tech debt, right?
Okay,
so if you want to not support transparent addresses, you now have to give people some either technology, some SDK updates, or help them with the engineering effort of supporting only shielded addresses, right? It's actually a hard transition to make. It was actually one of the reasons why we never supported Zcash in transparent mode at all, because we knew that if we wanted to support Zcash in private mode, we would end up having like these two Zcash wallets inside of Edge, right? One that derived keys for transparent and then one that used our Bitcoin library, because Zcash without privacy is just Bitcoin. It right. literally is just Bitcoin. You know, that would use our old Bitcoin code. And then we'd have these other wallets that support Zcash in private mode. But now we'd have two kinds of Zcash wallets, you know, but they have the same currency code, but different address types and both. And that just would be, you know, like I said, tech debt. So we, you know, took the stance that we're going to support it in full privacy mode by default from the very beginning. And I like that with Pirate Chain, that's the only thing you can support. There's no choice.
I know, that's awesome. So let me ask you, in terms of the legal landscape within crypto, there's a lot of talk about patents from various different individuals and entities, you know, from the privacy sector all the way to the Bitcoin sector. Like there's been a lot more talk about patents and possible enforcement of patent infringement. As a wallet, as a non-custodial self-custody exchange, how would you tackle something like this if it were to be presented to you? A situation where they would say, this protocol here is infringing on the patent held by this protocol there.
Got it. So in the open source world, it's pretty hard to establish patents after the fact, after you've already deployed code. So one of the rules in patents is if it is proven that it's already been adopted by some other party, then you can't really file the patent on it, right? So you have to prove that either you were both the one that had created this technology, this idea, and you're the first mover in using it. If you try to file a patent, but there's proof that someone else is already doing that, and they've been doing it from before you even started the filing of the patent, then it's hard to prove that you really invented it. Really, it's who's the inventor of this technology, right? And in order for you to file a patent, you have to prove that you are the inventor of that technology. But if it's already been used, even if someone didn't file a patent against it, it becomes very difficult, if not impossible, to file a patent. Hey, so-and-so has already used it. So that's like pre-existing condition. If you can identify that there's a pre-existing use, pre-existing condition of this technology, the patent filing usually dies. Right? That's why it's so expensive to file patents, because these lawyers have to be both smart, at least technical patents, lawyers have to be super smart, almost engineers, and then they have to be legal, and they have to dig through millions of decades of history of technology to see whether or not this was already used before. That's why and personally, I absolutely hate patents. I'll go on record as saying I'm not a fan of patents. I actually have a patent to my name. I didn't pay a dime for it. At the time I was working for NVIDIA, I had an idea on how to save energy using graphics inside of a graphics chip and drivers for a graphics chip, presented the idea, and the company's like, ooh, that's a good idea. We should patent it. I'm like, all right, I worked for you. You paid me to during the time that I thought about it. So I can't really argue with that. Right. Edge, however, has absolutely no patents, right? And not only do we not have any patents, our code is open source. So any ideas we have can be borrowed. And what I like about this is similar to skateboarding, in that people don't notice, but some of the greatest skateboarders really didn't create those awesome moves on their own. They built on the backs of legends, right? People from way before them had created like the basics of these moves, which they built on top of and built on top of and built on top of. But that forces you as a skateboard innovator to keep innovating on top of yourself. And when you stop innovating, you stagnate, and someone takes your old ideas, builds on them faster than you, and then there you go. You become dust, right? So that's what I like about the absence of patents, is that people can build on top of each other, A, and B, it forces you to stay innovative. Unfortunately, we are in the world of patents, and until we fully wipe out patents, it actually is at a disadvantage to companies like us. So we do this, admittedly, not for our own advantage. Like, investors probably would love for us to have patents. But I didn't get into Bitcoin purely to have a big $1 billion exit. I got into it for a very ideologically strong reason that I think can make really good money for both ourselves and our investors. I got into this to really fix problems in the world. So patents, I think, absolutely suck. They hinder innovation. They hinder keeping companies innovative. Getting back to your original question, like, hey, what do I think about this space? Crypto and blockchain is by and large very open source. For someone like, say, I know, like we were talking about Craig Wright trying to file patents, for him to try to claim that these are patents that he owns, he would have to prove that he invented them before anyone had used them, right? If people are already using these things and he's trying to file a patent today, it's too late. Cat's out of the bag. People have already started using these technologies, too late. Now, there's one case where I'm kind of okay with patents, and that's where it's basically a defensive patent, where you want to make sure that that technology won't be patented by anyone else, right? You patent it for the sake of protecting the ability for the community to use it. Now, those are called defensive patents. The problem with them is really who owns the patent. And could they change their mind in the future and say, we don't really want to make it defensive. Now we're going to go on the offensive and sue people for having used our idea. And so I don't know a good way of really filing defensive patents, but I'm not a lawyer. I think some lawyers probably should chime in on this podcast and say, oh, here's a good way, Paul, to file defensive patents. Maybe put this clause in here saying that no one can be charged for using this patent. All right. Maybe there's a way to say it to do that. I don't know. Those I would be definitely okay with. Prevents other companies from trying to file. Although in theory, just by using the idea and deploying it in a product, that already is a defensive patent, because other people can't patent it anymore once someone has actually deployed it in production. All right. So that's my understanding of patents, where we sit as the crypto space. It's beautiful. The crypto space is open source, hence making it very difficult for people to apply any patents that would affect a lot of the industry.
Right on. So I asked you this last time I had you here on the Crypto Vigilante, but I'm going to ask you again. How are you? Do you guys already have an application for the desktop?
We kind of, not really. I just recently purchased one of these new MacBook M1, MacBook Pros, and Edge runs amazingly well on it on the desktop. As many people may know, you can actually take mobile apps that were built for iOS, iPhone and iPad, and run them on the MacBook, and they run really, really well. And so I've actually been using Edge on my desktop. As far as us building a desktop application that runs natively on desktop on multiple platforms like Windows and Linux, that we have not deployed yet. Although one of the biggest technology pivots we did in Edge is to change the coding language that we built Edge on versus Airbits. Airbits is very tied to mobile, iOS and Android. However, Edge is built on technology that ports pretty well onto desktop. And our hope is, as far as time frame, like once again, please don't quote me any time frames. Our hope is that hopefully by like Q2, Q3, we get started on the desktop implementation. When we finish, it's hard to say because, you know, we're still a small team. We might get started on an implementation. I could estimate it if we had a team that could do nothing but that, meaning, hey, go work on desktop for the next 6 months. Great. But as you know, things always interrupt in between. Those same developers might have to implement things in our mobile app. They might have to fix a few bugs. You know, some blockchains change and fork, and we've got to integrate new SDKs and patch our code. Unlike traditional tech, blockchain tech and crypto tech is ever evolving and changing and breaking what you've already written, such that you now have to update your code. So we definitely want a desktop app. It's something we've talked about as being on our roadmap for this year numerous times, but can't promise it yet, but we definitely do would love to have deploy one out within, you know, hopefully later in the year.
But that's cool. I did not know that you could use the iOS application on a MacBook.
Yep, on the newer MacBooks, any of the M1 Apple Silicon MacBooks.
On the M1, it has to be an M1.
It has to be an M1 because it's basically the same chip as what's on the iPhone and iPad. So that makes it where there's not really much that, you know, Apple has to do. So yeah, it works beautifully, runs really well, runs real fast. Great interface with keyboard and mouse trackpad. Yeah, so definitely for those that already have an M1, just go to your app store, you can download Edge, give it a try. Let us know what you think.
Yeah, now I'm checking to see if I have an M1. I know I do have at least one M1 I can play with. That's okay. Super cool. I'm definitely going to try it. I do have one M1 for sure.
Oh, perfect. Oh, there you go.
But I'm excited. I'm really excited to try it out. Yep. So cool, Paul.
And then it, yeah. Yep.
Were you going to say something?
I was going to say that I think the Android version can run also on some computers using some simulator software, but it's not as buttery smooth as running the Edge iOS on an M1, right? There's some Android simulators to run on like Windows and Macs, but I wouldn't recommend it from the user experience point of view just yet. You know, so it'll be better when we deploy a full desktop app.
Cops just went by, watch out. So Paul, it's awesome to have you here. And
yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome. And so what's in the future for Edge?
Well, on the travel side, I will be speaking in Anarchapulco in February. So
nice.
I know that's right up the alley for a lot of your listeners. You know, I haven't been in the past, I think, year or two, you know, the whole pandemic bullshit and whatnot. And so, but yeah, making it out there in February, I'll actually be making a stop either before or after in Mexico City. They got a great crypto Bitcoin meetup scene over there.
So yeah, they do.
A little bit of the travel. We'll as well be at Bitcoin 2022 in April and likely at Consensus in June. So that's our travel schedule, event schedule. We love meeting the community in person, like in the flesh, meet space, as opposed to this whole virtual, like, you know, virtual is great and all. It's great to kind of connect when you can't connect, but there's nothing like, you know, breaking bread together, shaking hands, giving the hugs, so knowing that we're real people, you know,
by the way,
just random developers.
Monerotopia is going to be happening at the same time as Bitcoin 22.
Monerotopia.
Monerotopia.
Oh, no way. Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's going to be right down
over there as well.
Yeah.
I wonder if I wonder if shitcoin is going to happen at the same time too. I know Ken Bozak's been doing his like little shitcoin conference. He said he was going to follow the Bitcoin conference around with his conference. So we might swing by that one as well. So Monerotopia, I'll keep an eye on that one for sure.
Awesome.
But as far as development, definitely expect, you know, a few more assets, especially in the DeFi space. We're really excited about DeFi. A lot of DeFi is going to be coming in. Admittedly, DeFi is probably not you want to get into if you want like really high level of privacy, but it's a whole lot better than having to go like take out loans from banks. So it's a bit of a trade-off. It's not as private as like, you know, your pirate chain, Monero, Zcash, but it's a whole lot better than using traditional financial services. So that we're really excited about. You should see some heavyweight, deep integration of DeFi services integrated right inside of Edge. You don't have to use some separate app. You'll build it right inside of the app. So
Because after you implement Pirate Chain into Edge, and then you're going to do DeFi, the next step is going to be DarkFi. Have you heard of DarkFi?
Yep. Oh, I've heard of it. Yeah. So I'm keep my eyes to to the ground for it. Not looking at it like every day, but I'm trying to check out what it's like for people to even build apps on it and see what that'll feel like. So, but yeah, once it starts getting a little bit further baked out, I'm excited to see some actual DeFi projects port over into DarkFi.
So have you been get
private financial services?
Have you been keeping an eye on Dero, D-E-R-O, the Dero project? It's the
not privacy closely. Ethereum. I've heard of it. Not super close, but I have heard of it. Yeah. So it's another private mode smart contract is my understanding.
Correct. Private by default.
Yeah, so, exactly.
Yeah. We're excited, about that one. Yep. Yeah. It's pretty cool stuff, right?
Like that it is.
Yeah. It really gets me to geek out because it's just wild to me to build smart contracts in a place that is truly censorship resistant. I've never experienced that. You know, I mean,
it's never existed. This is a kind of a game changer. It's definitely a very fresh and new thing. So, how it's possible is like cryptography. That's way over my head. It's past my pay grade. I can't quite understand it. As long as enough smart people that are, you know, reputable in the industry claim that yes, this cryptography is pretty solid and then it can work for doing these smart contracts, I'll have to take it, you know, I'll have to take and trust that, you know, I don't believe in trust, don't verify on honesty. You want to minimize having to trust, but we have to trust someone in our life, right? It's really, really, you wouldn't be able to get anywhere if you didn't trust anyone. So look for some good reputable cryptographers that you can trust that is what I'm looking for that can validate this stuff actually works. So
no, for sure.
I'm excited about it.
And that's what, you know, without that community of trust, that web of trust,
it's like a web of trust, exactly.
Yeah, we wouldn't be here, and so that's why it's important to really emphasize peer-reviewed audits and really incentivize people to verify code. So
exactly.
So I'm going to send you a link to a presentation given by the Dero community at the last TCV summit, so that you can just watch it. And I'll put it in the description here below for everyone watching this as well.
You're awesome. Cool.
Awesome.
Well, thanks.
Thank you so much for your time, Paul. It's really cool. And I can't wait to see you at Anarchapulco. That's going to be great.
I'll see you over there. Yeah, it'll be good times.
Good Raphael. Stuff, guys.
Take care.
Peace, love, anarchy, guys. Take it easy. Bye.